Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. I want to thank you for joining me here in the first weekend of January 2021. We are gradually gaining daylight here as we pass the solstice and looking forward to the spring and summer to come, but still have several months of winter left to go. As always, if you're getting out and seeing stuff, I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there. The conversation I have for this week's show is one I recorded just a couple of days ago with returning guests, Brooke Schaefer and Paul Norwood. We'll go ahead and join the conversation with me asking Brooke a little bit about her increased use of iNaturalist in recent months. And Brooke, in particular, I've noticed that you seem to have started posting a lot more stuff on iNaturalist. So I'm just curious to hear what's kind of been inspiring you with observations and what you're working on.
Yeah, I know. I was wondering too why suddenly I was doing it. It's not like it's something new to my life. Paul has been really involved in it for a good long time, and we often go out together. So it's not like it's some new thing that I was introduced to. But I think what really probably changed in my life was just my schedule changed, as I think many people's did this year. And so I found myself going out for longer periods of time, going out alone, going out multiple times a day. In the past, you know, I usually got outside every day, but it was sort of, I had short amounts of time that I could go outside. And now suddenly that changed this year. So I think it all started with running into you, Matt, when that great horned owl was hanging out on Lazaria Drive. And I just happened to be walking by on one of my walks and saw it and was excited about it. And I was like, huh, I walk over here all the time. Why don't I just take a picture next time? And from there, it sort of springboarded into trying to actually do identification, starting to keep track of what I saw, trying to learn some of the things I saw, and living with Paul, who is like living with a kind of a encyclopedia in many ways. It makes it, he knows iNaturalist really well, and then he knows species really well. So it's made it really easy to jump in with both feet. In some ways, the challenge is more like finding the balance between using him as a resource and a tool and a great mentor, someone who I can learn a lot from, and also trying to make sure that I'm doing it on my own too, you know, that I'm learning the skills on my own, that I'm not just using him as like my identifier. It's been fun to like see how he uses a key and to begin to use a key and to learn some of the language for identifying different parts of plants and to get excited about looking through the microscope together. There have been a lot of really fun things about doing it with someone who has a lot of skill and experience. So it's been a really fun couple of months for me.
Nice. Yeah, I noticed you're up over 200 species now. So you're the newest member of the Sitka 200 Club, I guess.
Ooh. We were just looking at iNaturalist, and it seems like it's really close to having, was it 5 people, Paul, that are going to be over 1,000 species?
Yeah, another club, the 1,000 Club.
Yes. Connor, my son, has been very obsessively shooting. He wants to get to 1,100 for the year. His initial goal was 1,000, and then he's like, he was close enough to 1,100 that he's like, I got to get there. So he's been going out and posting lots of pictures of mosses and liverworts and all sorts of stuff, trying to get himself to the get himself to that thing. But yeah, there is several folks. Roland has been doing a lot this year, and Kitty has a lot, especially in the state. She has over 1,000 for the state, but not quite as many for Southeast Alaska.
And, but she's close to 1,000, I think, for yes, Southeast. Yeah. And Roland is very close also. Roland Worth.
Yes.
And then Karen Johnson's been seeing a lot of things. And then there's a person down in Ketchikan who goes by, I think, Mad Hip 11, who's been seeing a lot of things, really cool things.
That person, I think, is a scuba diver, and so is posting a lot of stuff from underwater, which has been kind of cool. I won't say there's no end of new things that people haven't seen, but there's we're a long way from the end of finding the other organisms that spend their time around here. So it's kind of interesting just to see what folks are seeing in their various places that they seem to, you know, it's interesting. I've like, because I look at all the observations that come in, and you get to know the people that are posting a lot, sort of. I mean, you get to know them through their posting and the sort of places they go. And so I just enjoy seeing what folks are seeing. And then it inspires me to say, like, oh, I haven't seen that thing. I need to go get out and look for it.
It's really nice having you out there, Matt. I have to say, as someone who's getting into iNaturalist now, like, it's, you're just another great resource. And like, it makes a novice like myself feel like, oh, okay, I got this one right, or, oh, I got this one wrong. Or I remember there are numerous things that I struggle with identifying, but I'm thinking in particular of the greater and lesser scop. And I still struggle with identifying that. I'm not totally sure, you know, that I would feel like I could successfully do it, but it's just nice to like know that I can put up an attempt and an ID and put a comment in there too. Like, here's what I think. I really don't know. Can anyone help? And then I know that, like, I hopefully will hear back from you. It's nice to know that you're seeing everything that people locally put up and that we can use you as a resource as well.
Yeah, it's something that, you know, over the years, a lot of what I've learned has been through the help of others, for sure. I'm not as much, one of the things that I appreciate about Paul's posting and then you've started to follow suit is you're actually doing the work to identify things much more so than, I think I described it to you when I ran into you all at Stargava one time, that I really embraced the approach of how we recognize people. So you don't, if you're going to go meet somebody, you know, you don't pull out your field guide to people and say, all right, well, they're 5'7" and have brown eyes and blonde hair, you know, and that sort of thing. We just know who they are. And there is this kind of awkward time if you're being asked to meet somebody you've never met before, and then you have the sort of the field marks. Well, I'll be wearing a pink coat or whatever it is that they do to help you be able to recognize them. But then once you see them and you, for most of us, like, we don't need to have them described to us again. We just know what they look like. And we recognize them. And then when we become really familiar with them, like, you can see somebody from a far distance away and often surprisingly have a pretty good idea. Oh, that's so-and-so way over there. Mm-hmm. And it's like, there's nothing that you can really see about them specifically that you would be able, like, you can't see the detail, but it's just something about the way they move, the way they carry themselves, that you just recognize them. And so I've kind of really embraced that approach to learning things. I mean, it isn't quite as simple as that. I definitely have to look at field marks and those sorts of things, but I'm always kind of doing it with the mind of I want to learn to recognize this. And the challenge to that is that the hardest part for me is getting the name in the first place. Once I get the name a few times and start to recognize it and its different variations, how it shows up here, I usually feel pretty confident as far as that goes. I say it looks like this. However, sometimes my concept of what it looks like is off. And so another expert that knows better will come in and say, oh, well, actually you have this and that, and they both look pretty similar, but here's how you tell them apart. And then over time, you know, my understanding refines. But scops are an example of that, where it's pretty easy to identify a scop as a scop. That's relatively straightforward, but learning to recognize the sort of subtleties between the greater and the lesser scop are a little trickier. And sometimes you just have to leave it as a scop species. You know, you can tell it's a scop, but not much more than that. And it is an interesting process, though, as in doing that and kind of getting the help from folks that don't mind doing the microscope work that's necessary in some cases for bryophytes and fungi especially. And Kitty's been really helpful with that over the years, and Paul's been helpful with that over the years. So it's kind of, I feel like it's a nice collaborative thing where we're learning. For me, I like to think about it as getting to know the neighbors. You know, we're learning the other organisms that we share this place with. So, and plenty of diversity out there to be explored.
Yeah, and the more you look, the more you see. Like, the more you bend over just another foot closer to the ground, and suddenly you see a whole another set of things. Or you go out tide pooling and you lift up a rock and, oh, there's a whole ecosystem right there. So yeah, just like, the more you look, the more you see that there's more to see.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, you mentioned tide pooling, and I think you all made it out one of the earlier low tides this fall. And I don't know, Paul, have you done a lot of nighttime intertidal stuff, low tide stuff over the years?
I mean, I've done a little bit of it. Yeah.
Yeah. I'd gone out a couple of times over the past years, and usually windy and cold, and I didn't have a lot of patience for it. I went out to Sandy Beach or something, the 20-degree air with wind on top of it was not my idea of a good time. But Connor has been getting out pretty religiously this fall for the evening low tides. And so I went down to the park. Now that I'm back through my entire backlog of photos, I have this streak of new species each month that goes back to, I think 2016 was the last time I didn't add a new species to iNaturalist. And so now I have to work a little harder for it because I can't rely on my photo backlog. So I've been, he said, well, I've been finding these nudibranchs. You can come down and get a nudibranch. So I went down in one evening and I don't remember what kind of nudibranch it is. I remember what it looked like. I don't remember the name, but, he found those and several other things. I spent some time and we've had a relatively warm December, so it wasn't really that cold. And then went down a couple of other evenings in that low tide series. And I found it really interesting just how different the beach experience is. And I imagine it's a combination of things, but in part, like it's easier to find stuff in some ways. Maybe they're more active, but I think it has as much to do with the way that the headlamp focuses my attention. Like I can only see one thing and maybe some things catch the light a little differently when it's that kind of focused directed light rather than the diffuse daylight. It just was interesting to be down there and to see those things. And I have no idea when I'm going to get to the end of, but that's certainly one of the places I will be focusing to get my new species. It's just seems like every time down to the beach, if you spend a little time, you end up finding something new.
I like how that, we all seem to kind of come up with goals with iNaturalist using this tool as a way to kind of figure out what we see and how we meet a goal and it doesn't seem to stop anyone. Like you were saying, Connor earlier changed his goal from 1,000 to 1,100 for the year. And you're trying to get a new species now. And I know I did the exact same thing when I started up. I was like, I'll just try to get 50 species before the year was out. And then that was just so, I reached it quickly that it just moved the goal a little bit further. It's not a stopping point for anyone. We just continue to shift what we're striving for, which I think is fun. I think it's kind of cool that something about this tool kind of keeps you engaged and wanting to an excuse to find more.
Yeah. It's funny. Connor said something to that effect the other day. He says, you know, if I hadn't started iNaturalist, I probably would have just stayed being into birds and mammals. But now yeah. I got to find everything. And he's on a quest to get all the nudibranchs in Alaska. So he's got 20 some nudibranchs now and he's being very focused. I mean, cause you could take it a lot of different ways. Like a lot of my stuff has just been very like, I'm out, I'm wandering around and I just see what I see and I notice something that looks different. So I take some pictures, try to figure out what it is. But there's been a few things that I've been, oh, I know that's out there and I want to go find it. And so you can use the references, the field guides and say, oh, these things are things that should be here. I'd really like to see that. And then you start, you know, going on these targeted quests, so to speak. And so there is, yeah, there's a lot of variety of ways that as you say, that the goals can be flexible. And, you know, when you meet one, there's plenty more that can be chosen just based on, you know, what your interests are and what you like to do. And I find the numbers motivating. Earlier this year, I crossed 2,000 species for which was a motivating number for me. It's like it's an arbitrary number in the end. It's not any more exciting in some ways than 2001, but but it's kind of that milestone there. And so since then, I'm like, and I have this long-term dream of getting 1,000 species in a day. And wow. I don't know if it's feasible, but I kind of do some things that are like, well, just sort of testing the waters and thinking what kind of training regimen do I need to give myself to even be able to begin to do that. I wouldn't call those big, I've done a few big days now where I just try to get as many species as I could. And I wouldn't call them fun.
How many species did you end up with, though, on one of these big day kind of trial runs? Like, how many species did you get?
I think, for those, I usually go with taxa. And I think that my highest count was, I'm pretty sure I got to 500.
Okay.
One day.
And this is like a up at dawn, out on the beach, and then also you're doing it in the summer so you can get up to some mountaintop kind of situation?
Yes. It's interesting. And my strategy has changed. In the beginning, when I was first trying it, I thought, well, I'll do as many, I'll hit different habitats. And so I wanted to go up on the mountain and hit the beach and all of those things. And then I realized how big a penalty travel time is, because when you're traveling, you're not observing. And if you're really looking to maximize species, you have to be like constantly observing pretty much. So I stopped, I kind of reduced the amount of travel I was doing and focused on closer things. But I got over 500 taxa, in 464 species on a day in July. So it was a low tide day, one of the low tide series. That particular time, I went up Harbor Mountain the night before and stayed at the shelter and then walked back to and start, you know, got up. I didn't get up at dawn. I wasn't quite that motivated, but I got up, you know, not quite at first light, but made my way back. The low tide, I think, was around 6 or 7 in the morning. And so my goal was to be down to the beach before the low tide, so you have more time down there. But it ended up taking me quite a bit longer doing the observations on the mountain, coming back on the trail. But I did that. Then I went to Magic Island and hit that low tide and got a bunch of stuff there. Took a brief break for lunch and got some stuff at C-Mart to eat and then observed while eating essentially at Pioneer Park. My kids were with me for the first part of the day. And then I can't remember for sure, but I think I went out to Stargavin that day as well. And also did a little bit of, I didn't go back to Harbor Mountain Road, went over to the airport and the long-term parking area there, where there's a lot of kind of introduced species that are weedy. Mm-hmm. And then I ended the day walking around kind of Indian River and Totem Park and hit the evening low tide at the beach and got a few more things at the beach there. And then came home. So at the end of the day, I think it ended up being something like out and going for 16 or so hours.
Wow.
It's a long day.
But you got halfway to your ultimate goal. So I'm curious, like, with what you learned from that experience, how would you, like, if you were to do this again, which I'm guessing you're going to, what's your new tactic?
Well, so I've done it. I've actually done it. That was the second, that best time was the second time that I did it. And then after that, I started focusing more on saying, okay, well, that was 500. I could probably, using the approach that I did that day, if I was slightly more efficient, got up a little earlier and did stuff, I probably could bump that up to 600, maybe 700.
Wow.
But that still leaves 300 species to go, which is a lot. So I, last year I wasn't going to do a big day, and then I did end up doing one, and I didn't go up Harbor Mountain at all that day. I was like, you know, going up Harbor Mountain is at least 30 to 40 minutes of drive time. Maybe I'm better off, you know, staying closer to home, so to speak. And that day it happened that my parents were in town that weekend. It was another low tide. I went to, I just got up in the morning and went to Magic Island, and I didn't spend as much time actually out in the field because I was, because I spent some time with my family during the day, went back into town and picked them up, and we all went out to, Stargavin, and I, dad and son did some berry picking while I was doing some observations and stuff. But that day I still ended up with 476 taxa, despite not going up Harbor Mountain. And so that started to, but I spent more time looking at smaller things, you know, and really trying to get the bryophytes and the lichens a little better and that sort of thing. Instead of focusing on the sort of obvious plants and birds are just sort of an afterthought, and insects as well. You know, you just kind of, if you happen to see some, you observe them while you're out, but I didn't target them.
Although I have to say that, like, you must be really good at bryophytes and lichens, and because those things, for someone like me, take a super long time, and I might never get the ID on it.
Right. So that's the other aspect, right? So I have to decide. Well, part of the reason that the 1,000 species is in a day is a goal is because it feels like it's sort of like your capstone project for me. Mm-hmm. Like, if my bigger project has been getting to know the neighbors, the only way that I can do 1,000 species in a day is to know what stuff is in the field. I can't be searching for stuff. Right. I just have to know what it is. I have to recognize it and take its picture and move on. And so that's a limiting factor, right? And that's actually where I need to get better. I did what I'm calling a big ish day, just Christmas Eve day. It was a nice day. And so I walked from my house basically, and I haven't got everything in yet, but I think I'll end up with about 200 species for that day. But I realized as I was doing that there was a lot of times I was just searching, like there's a rock and there's several different species there, or there's a tree with a lot of different epiphytes on it, and I'm searching and looking and trying to notice things, like things that you already are familiar with stand out more easily in some ways. Like, you know, you can see that as something instead of it just being a mass of green, in the case of plants, or whatever other colors in the case of lichens. Your brain becomes more efficient at sorting as you get to recognize them. So I think if I really have a hope of getting to 1,000 in a day, I'm going to have to really learn the lichens and the bryophytes much better than I already know them. Like, I know quite a few of them, you know, on the order of dozens that I could go out and any given day and find and recognize and be able to observe that way. But I probably need to up that number by a bunch, because there's a lot of stuff around here, especially with lichens that, and again, here the problem is getting the IDs, the names in the first place, and learning or getting them identified and learning how to separate them from any similar looking species.
I'm curious, Paul, what your approach would be as someone else who is pretty familiar with a large number of species. Like, if you were to try to do this, have a big day as well, would you try to be in the water? Would you try to be near the water? What would be your approach?
Well, in the water, I think just takes too much time to get, okay, like, the suit on and off and shower and hang the suit and rinse it and all that. But for sure, town is really critical, I think, because it has not only native species, but also all the introduced species that you're not going to find really anywhere else. And so there's quite a bit of diversity right downtown. And then, the low tide, and basic plants. Another thing I think that I would do is probably spend time afterwards. So grab clumps of moss and then sort them out later, kind of thing. I feel like a lot of times you have to sort through the material to find it. And I don't know how much of that actually counts, because if you're grabbing a bunch of moss and then finding that, oh, there's like three liverworts growing in this clump also, and there are three different ones, and there's also we just found a rotifer like swimming around in the underneath the glass slip as we were looking at a moss leaf. I mean, that's, yeah, it was that day. Was it really that day? I don't know. We can make our own rules as we go.
Yeah.
And in the end, it is very much it's kind of a personal thing. I think it would be fun to, for me, that particular quest is a very personal, and in the end, it's like whatever rules you set for yourself. Right. It is kind of funny to imagine just like bringing hay bales full of mosses and lichens and stuff, and then spending the next month, you know, sorting through and seeing what all the stuff you got.
So what are the next things that are going to get added? Like, what are the next exploration areas as far as species? Like, we were just kind of chatting about things that are possible, impossible. I think, for example, as far as I'm concerned, springtails are basically impossible.
There's some folks on iNaturalist that are good at identifying them. It's been interesting how many of the springtails that I've posted I've gotten names for. There's a guy on Bug Guide. He doesn't seem to use iNaturalist, but a guy named Franz. There's, I think it's calembola.org, which I think has a bunch of information about identifying them. You'd think that it'd be pretty hard, but they seems like they're not as hard as I would have guessed.
How many are there out there? I mean, is it like on the order of moths? Is it on the order of, I mean, because some things are very diverse and others aren't, but it seems like there's, as far as numbers of springtails in Sitka, of individual springtails, like there's zillions in right. every garden.
Yeah, for sure. So there seem to be some common species that show up pretty routinely, and it's hard to say how long of a tail there is in terms of things that are around but aren't as common. So I don't know that anybody's really focused on observing springtails. They're very small. They're easy to overlook. But if you actually look at them and, you know, get a good close macro shot or look in a microscope, a lot of them have interesting patterns and designs, and they're actually kind of cool looking. And then some of them have different, there's a little chubby, look like little, you know, sort of Michelin man pets or something like that. and then the globular springtails, which have this kind of, and often they have eye dots on them that make it look like they have these big, you know, oversized eyes. And some of them are bright colors. Some of them, there's iridescent colored ones. It's hard to say, but my guess is there's not a huge amount of diversity. Like it's a wild guess, but based on my complete lack of knowledge, except for the few species that I've found already, I'm guessing it's kind of like similar to the birds in terms of number of species. So, you know,
yeah,
maybe less, you know, maybe a couple hundred at most kind of thing. But I honestly don't know.
So is that the kind of thing that you're working into yourself because you have this, you know, to put up new species for yourself, and you've reached a huge goal of 2000 and you've kind of gone through your catalog, so what are you looking into now?
Well, the good news is that there are lichen and bryophyte checklists that are that are in the literature, so to speak. And I've brought into a website. And have there, and then I finished up going through all the vascular plants. I need to add a few that need to be added, but kind of making an annotated checklist, so to speak, and have started. It kind of started a long time ago, but have started to focus more on doing more of that with the bryophytes and the lichens. So I think I probably have in Sitka area alone, I probably have 200 or 300. Bryophytes and lichens that are reasonably common, like not impossible to find sort of things. Mm-hmm. But it's saying, oh, this is a thing to even look for, and then starting to be able to, know where to look and then looking for it specifically. So like in the last couple of weeks, I think I've found 2 or 3 different Hypogymnia species that are probably not that unusual, but I just never even thought to look for them. You know, you just kind of go, oh, that's a Hypogymnia. Those are kind of hard, I guess, maybe. I don't know. Mm-hmm. There's other things I'm going to look at. So I don't really pay much attention to them. But so that for me is the easiest, sort of the lowest hanging fruit. And then, you know, always being open to the random thing that shows up that I never knew was a thing before. And just kind of being, you know, curious about that. There's fungi. I just found a new to me fungus along the cross trail a couple days ago.
What was it?
It's a coral-like fungus, but it turns out it's more related to rushulas than the rest of the corals. And it was really pretty photogenic. It's kind of came from this base, but then had a lot of I don't know what you'd call them, like columns sticking up. And then each at the end has kind of had a little circle of points or something coming up off of it. So that was, you know, there's always more fungi out there. There's gazillions of fungi. And there's a lot of lichens, but again, lichens are, there's probably, I think Glacier Bay had, I think 600 or 700 lichens. Klondike National Park had 600 or 700 different kind of lichens, and Sitka is likely to have at least that many.
Wow.
So
part of me gets excited to hear that, and part of me gets really like, I don't know what the word is, because I personally love the lichens because they're beautiful, and you look at them up close and you think, wow, this is going to be so easy to figure out too. Like, not only do I think, wow, this is beautiful and interesting, and I feel like enthralled with this species, but then I think, gosh, and they're, you know, it's so unique. Like, I'll have no trouble finding this, identifying it. And then it remains beautiful and enthralling, but I certainly do not succeed at identifying it.
Some of them are easier than others. I found one this summer up on Harbor Mountain, and it's, now I don't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but it turns out there's a couple of different species that one could expect to find here. And you, in order to conclusively separate them, you need to look at their spores under a microscope. So I did make the collection, and I have the collection for somebody to look at some point. But, and the nice thing is every year there's better and better resources available for different things, both in terms of books and online, folks that are interested in stuff. There's somebody like insects is another one. There's a guy on iNaturalist, Ed Danko, I think. And he has created these fly guides, guides to Diptera. So if you have flies, you can kind of work them through at least to get to the, you know, to get to the group. And like, there's more details on some groups of flies, the flower flies, for example. And so, so it's places like iNaturalist, and then the crossing over of expertise. So you have folks that are really interested in particular groups that you can get help with, get help with those IDs, or at least pointers on what you need that you don't have. So when you see it again, you can go, oh, I need to do this in order to be able to confirm what it is.
That's and right.
So that it's just kind of this iterative process of learning what to look for and how to look for it.
Yeah, it's certainly, you do get to know kind of like what you were talking about earlier, starting to get the sense of a species or, you know, whatever it is you're looking at, kind of going through the process of trying to ID things from photos, you know, or your time in the field, you do come to know them so much more intimately. You're like, oh, I can't just take a picture of this flower. I'm going to need to also see what the leaves are like and what the roots are like. You really do get to know these species a lot more intimately deeply.
Or like the rock sole that was our latest thing. So I've seen lots of rock soles, not lots, but, you know, handfuls of rock soles. And, you know, even without counting the ones, you know, commercial fishing and processing flatfish. But so these rock soles, there's two of them, the northern rock sole, the southern rock sole. And I always knew, I kind of have to have both sides, right? And like, it's a general rule with flatfishes. You have to have both sides. And you have to kind of see there's this weird midline that has an arch on the top side, the eyed side. And you kind of have to know the pattern on that. And this time, instead of filleting them on board, on the boat, I brought them back whole because I knew that they're difficult. And I found out that you have to count the gill rakers to have like a really easy way to identify them. And there you go, done. Southern rock sole. So that was kind of nice. It's an easy, basic number. If it has fewer than 10 gill rakers, it's a southern. And if it has more, then it's a northern. And that's it.
And we just never would have known, you know, about this difference had we not like been trying to identify it. Like, we got to know it so much better.
Yeah, it is flatfish are another one of those that I'm like, I have a book, whatever that little field guide is that the Alaska Sea Grant published.
Mm-hmm.
So I have that book and I kind of look at it and I go, I'm not sure. And it's like everything, you know, when you just get started, you don't have a real, it just takes time to kind of start to get the lay of the land, so to speak. Lay of the fish in this case and figure out. So yeah, it's important to get both sides and then, all right, in some cases. And then as you get down smaller and smaller, a lot of times it is just something as simple as that. Not always. The other thing that I've noticed over time is that as you, it's sometimes you do need those particular bits, like the chemical test in a lichen, or maybe the counting of the gill rakers. And that's an easy sort of thing to look at. But as you get to know it, I found that a lot of things, they just look like they look. And it would be difficult to explain what that is. And that's why they don't use it in the keys. But when you know what it is, like, it just looks like it. And you can, of course, confirm with these particular things that are there. And so that's where I go back to, like, how I am with people. I don't need to know that, you know, somebody's 6'3" or 5'7" or whatever. I don't need to know all the details about them necessarily to identify them. I just they look like themselves. And so I've kind of, that's been a bias of mine, I guess, an underlying premise that most things, not everything, but most things are going to be recognizable when you get to know what they are. And so it's a combination of learning those little bits that, you know, maybe the northern and the southern Roxhill are one of those pairs where it's really easy to tell it's one of those two. Mm-hmm. and then you need that one thing to distinguish between them. And I think of that as like the equivalent of being identical twins for people. You know, it's like, oh, one of them has the mole there and the other one doesn't. So it's mm-hmm. this tiny little thing that allows you to tell them apart.
It makes me think a little bit of probably, I feel like something you've experienced, Matt, as a human, and I've experienced with the thing of how we can tell each other apart. Like when people are just getting to know you and then maybe they meet your brother, they maybe think you're twins, they can't tell you apart. I've had that experience with my sister, where the people just think we're identical, you know. And then I don't know in your case, but for me and my sister, we don't look alike. Like we look very different, but it takes, like, people have to get to know us to see that we're look different. And I think that maybe you've experienced that with your brother, like the two of you, like, look very different in your minds and to people who know you both. But when you're first meeting people, they have a hard time differentiating you.
Yes, that has happened. And it's often very surprising. I'm like, right. What? We don't look anything alike. What are you talking about?
No, but yeah, I can't get my mind around doing it yet with species, but I see what you're saying. I hear what you're saying as far as like, just the more you know something, the more you can identify it without necessarily having to count the whatever, the rakers or whatever it might be that you're using when you initially get to know something.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting how your sense of it as well shifts, because there's certainly been times when I have just decided that everything was this one species or whatever. And then somebody comes along and goes, well, actually, it'd be just like deciding all the scops here were greater scops. Mm. And maybe most of them are, but there's still plenty of lesser scops around. And I just kind of stopped looking at that point. I recognized the scopness and had in my mind that they were all greater scops. And so that's happened with other things with me before, where then somebody would say, well, did you ever consider that it might be this other thing that looks kind of similar? And I hadn't. And so then I begin that process of separating those out. And then often I still have the sense of scopness or whatever, you know, that cluster might be. But then I also have the ability to separate them out in a way. And I suppose that's what's like there's definitely family resemblances. Mm-hmm. So I have to acknowledge that my brother and I, there's certainly a family resemblance there, even though I'm not really attuned to it because I'm attuned to seeing the differences much more than the similarities there. So it is kind of interesting how that works. And with, you know, my brother talked about learning plants here and then traveling in Europe, there would be species that they reminded him of things that he already knew. And often they were related, you know, maybe in the same family or something like that. It wasn't always the case, but so there is this kind of resemblance that happens. And I suppose, you know, you all have traveled a bit, and I know Paul's done some natural history stuff in different parts of the world as well. I don't know if you have, Brooke, as much, but I'm just kind of curious if you've had that experience as you develop your sort of knowledge of this place or a particular place. And granted, in different places, there's some very different plants and animals and things. But are there some similarities and overlaps, the skills and the recognition stuff? Do you find that it translates some?
I mean, it's really fun to see Of course, things are completely different. Like, it'd be fun to go to the fynbos of South Africa and see proteas in the wild. But there's also just weirdly universal or weirdly patchy distribution patterns in certain things. And we live in the Northern Hemisphere, like most people. The Northern Hemisphere is mostly land. So we have a fair number of Holarctic species that are found all the way around the north, especially as you go further north, that becomes even more and more true. I've been just getting into liverworts this month, for example, and there's both the familiar pattern of this thing is found everywhere from like Ireland to Newfoundland and everywhere in between going east. But then there's also weird patterns. Like there's a liverwort that I saw that somebody had observed off the coast of Madagascar and also found here. And there's some that are only found in, say, the Queen Charlotte Islands in Japan. So just fascinating distribution patterns. And then, of course, there's familial aspects. And then there's also things that will fool you, like the southern beech forest in southern Chile, for example. Completely unrelated, but it's it will make you think it's something that you're familiar with, but then it's unrelated. Kind of like the southern diving petrels, for example, that are that look like our little alcids and they're not.
Hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. And Brooke, you did mention the themes and the goals and so forth. And I guess we didn't hear from Paul. If Paul, if you have a sort of a theme or approach and sort of currently guiding your iNaturalist and naturalizing efforts.
I'm kind of starting to think that I'm slowly heading towards 2000, where you're at. And I'm thinking one way to get there is to actually know what I'm uploading in a way that I feel like I'm not seeing the same thing twice, calling it two different things, which does happen if I'm not careful. And also to put up enough evidence on there that even if I don't know what it is now, I can go back later and maybe re-engineer it. And so that means things that I don't like. For example, there's groups of aloe mosses that are very unpleasant that require, I think, a lot of work and doing the microscopy on it and putting it up and trying to figure it out one step at a time so that when I see one that's different, then I might be able to pick it out. I know that my next big area of progress is to start trapping moths. That's one way to get like dozens and dozens of species.
The moths. You can get like a $20 UV light or something. And I just set that out on my porch along with my porch light and then check each evening and each morning in the summertime. And yeah, you mentioned that it's nice to be able to go back and identify things. And that's, I think, especially as you get to really get a feel for things and you don't necessarily need all the details that you need at first, but you know, you get to see what things look like that every so often I'll go back through old, especially if I'm working on a particular group, if I'm saying, all right, I want to learn like the Politrichaceae, the aloe mosses. And I've looked through a bunch of those. I've gone through a bunch of pictures. I kind of went through the field guide and kind of gathered all that. And then as part of my process of learning, I'll go through all of the observations that are identified, at least to that family from Southeast Alaska. And I'll look through them. I'll say, all right, do I know what this is? And if I don't, then, you know, what do I think it is? And kind of there's a process that all these photos allow me to kind of work with as well. And that helps me to better understand how things look and what I need to see in order to recognize them. So there's a few of those species that I think are pretty straightforward. And there's a lot that I suspect are not too bad once you get to know what they are, but figuring out what they are in the first place, you have to do these like leaf sections and look at the lamellae on the leaves and all of these different things that are, it's a little bit fussy, right? You know, you've got a lot of little details to look at. So they can be hard to get names on at the first place. But you had some nice leaf sections I saw in some of your observations.
He really does. He's been doing some great microscope work, and they're really fun. I think those pictures are cool. I think they're really fun to look at. So even if you can't look at it through the microscope, just to see the photos of them, they're kind of beautiful when you look at them up close like that.
Yeah.
Well, as we're airing this show, it will be into the new year, into 2021. And so I guess as we kind of wind down here, do you have any, I imagine you all like to travel and probably didn't travel as much this year as you might have in a normal year, but are there any kind of natural history related projects or ambitions that you have for the coming year?
Well, we've already been talking about getting up to the Alpine when the winter is over. So I think getting some nice hikes up to some mountains, maybe camping up there. But we do have some time set aside in early June, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Too. And so I think that will probably be a trip that is might not involve airplanes still. So I think that would be like a kayaking trip or something we can do that would be a local adventure. So that would probably be a good opportunity for us to do some continued iNaturalist work while we're out kayaking or heading out somewhere into the wilderness around here.
Yeah.
Nice.
And maybe some snorkeling in spring. That would be good. Yeah.
Well, depending on where you all head to, there's some plant species in particular that I'm like, well, they could be around here, but they aren't. Like, for example, there's a species of willow that it seems plausible could be found on the outer coast of Kruzov, for example. And I've been thinking it'd probably be nice to start like filling in the gaps. So there's these things that are expected to occur but haven't been documented or you know, those kind of things. That's the other, that's partly about finding new species, but it's also partly about just kind of filling in the gaps in the map, so to speak, about what kind of things are here. And so depending on where you end up going, you know, I might send you off with a hit list of things that, hey, keep an eye out for these things. They might be around.
That would be very useful.
It'd be fun too, because it's like an added, like, circumnavigating Kruzov is just something we've been talking about doing for years and years now and have never really gotten around to doing it. And just having another reason to do it, as if doing it isn't enough. But yeah, it just makes it a little more of an adventure, a little bit more of a treasure hunt of a goal. So yeah, that would be so much fun to have some things like that to help guide some of our trips. So what's on your list, Matt, for 2021? Where are you going to go?
There's a number of, you know, more ambitious hikes that I keep telling myself I'd like to go. Paul found an interesting buttercup back in the Sisters that I'd like to go get, but that's a pretty ambitious hike. But yeah, just kind of exploring and continuing to get out and see what's around and explore all the gaps. Today, even I went down, Connor had posted an observation of a moss and I was like, oh, it looks familiar, but I wasn't quite sure based on the picture. So I wanted to go. So he was actually off the edge, past Whale Park, just had gone over down towards the water where it's a steep drop down to the water, you know, but a lot of Sitka alders and some bigger trees and a lot of salmon berries. And so I went there and there was this whole like otter thing going on. Like, I think it was a place where land otters came and seemed like they were quite active there. Huh. I was curious about that. And it's like this place that I've driven by many, many times and walked by several times. And it's like literally a stone's throw from places I've been, but I didn't know.
Right.
So then it's just like, what are all these little places, you know, and just finding more of those kind of little pockets of interesting places and what's there. And kind of filling in those gaps. That's much more compelling to me than going further. I mean, it would be fun to get to South Baranof or some other places as well, but they're less practical. There's a lot of places to still explore that, you know, I could really literally just walk out my door and get to if I had a mind to. So that's kind of where I'm at, and also want to further develop kind of the annotated checklist of things to for references for both myself and for other people if they're cool. If they're so inclined, and so I'll probably keep plugging away at that.
That's great.
But yeah, no end of things. Maybe I think it'll be a while before I have any other round numbers. It's kind of into the slow phase here, unless I get really excited about lichens and bryophytes. Maybe I'll get to 2,500 taxa by the end of the year. But that's a little ways away for me. So
yeah. Well, my guess is what's going to happen is it's going to be there sooner than you think, and you're just going to have to move the goal, just shift it back.
Well, I have 114 taxa to go to get to 2,500. So that's reasonable with this year with a little bit of effort.
Right.
Especially if I'm trying to get new species along the way. And I'm curious, you know, what is our kind of ultimately, where do we really start to peter out in terms of numbers of species? Like I have hardly done any fish, so I might have to take up fishing.
You know, we just were looking though on iNaturalist, was the species number that has been reported in Sitka, was it 3,000?
I think so. Maybe it's southeast.
Okay. Somewhere around there.
It's over 3,000, right?
The nice thing about that is that there are people who are like doing the fish that are putting those observations up. So we get a better sense, you know, between everybody, how many species there might be out there.
Yeah. Sitka itself is at 3,033 taxa.
Okay.
Right now. And so probably not quite that many to species, but, and Southeast is more than that, but yeah, it is. What folks are posting, you know, pretty much everybody that posts very often at all, I've seen something on there that I go, oh, I need to go find that one. That one's a new one for me.
Right.
Connor just posted a picture of, it was a shield bug that had been infected by a fungus. Mm. So it had all the little sprouty fungus bits coming out of it. And so he'd left it there. So I went and collected it today, and you know, maybe there's somebody I can give it to that can identify it. But it was just interesting. Even if it never gets a species, it's just kind of one of those things that's out there.
Amazing.
I've been reflecting a little bit on, because it's such a gradual thing, like I don't know how my experience has changed over time. And then when I think about places I've been, and I think that'll be interesting to revisit places I've been before and have some memory of, and see how my experience is different going back now, and seeing the sorts of things that I see now. So, it's a wide world out there, I guess.
And you probably wonder, like, as a statistician, I mean, you were talking about how long the tail of like the Columbola distribution is. I mean, the springtail, so there's the ones that are always around, and then there's the rare ones. Like, how many rare ones are there? So of course, we're always, even from the beginning, we're going to be finding some of those really rare species that we might never see again. But like, when do we get to the point where we're starting to only really see rare things that we'll not see for a long time? So that's kind of interesting. And that could actually be maybe even quantified.
Yeah, that is an interesting. I've noticed that mostly with birds, it's a little easier because there's not as many of them. And this year, I got the last regularly occurring non-pelagic species. I haven't seen many pelagic birds, but I saw and photographed a snow bunting for the first time this year, and that was the last regularly occurring species that I hadn't seen in Sitka. But some of the species that I saw relatively early on actually aren't all that common, but I didn't know that at the time. At the time I was like, yeah, I saw that. Must not be that unusual. But with the benefit of another 15 years of hindsight, I can go, oh, actually that was kind of unusual. And I just didn't realize it at the time. And so, yeah, the same thing's probably happening with any number of things. I feel like I have a pretty good sense for most plants of how often they occur, at least around Sitka. I don't know about more generally, but at least around Sitka. And it is having that sense. I feel like when I go somewhere else, like if I go over to Kruzov, like it informs my sense of, oh, this is different. And here's why, because here's these things. Or if you go south of town and you start running into Salal and that kind of stuff, you're like, oh, this is actually not all that uncommon down here. But in Sitka along the road system, it isn't at all. There isn't any of it. So it's that's one of the things that in the longer term, I think might be interesting as well to do a little more exploring with is how Sitka fits within the context of Southeast Alaska. So like my biggest familiarity is with Sitka, but to do a little bit of traveling to different parts of the region and just seeing, oh, wow, here's some things that are like, I never see these in Sitka. And where's this thing that I always see in Sitka that isn't here at all? You know, I'm starting to notice some of those differences regionally and having a better sense of the distribution of things that way. And maybe even, you know, starting to hypothesize reasons that some of those things may be distributed the way they are. But those are feel like more longer term than one year sorts of aspirations. But I think that's as people from around the region start posting more and you know have a better record of these things, like some of that can start to be looked at.
And it will be interesting. I think that you actually already have a good step towards it. I mean, you've been doing this for long enough now, I think, and have enough pictures from, you know, that you are already working towards that long eye view.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a work in progress.
Yeah. It's nice to have those
and, things. Yeah. And the people that came before too, because, you know, the checklist for lichens and bryophytes represent an immense amount of field work from various people. Who contributed to those. And so I see myself in some ways and all of us really in this longer thread of people exploring this place and some for, you know, short intense periods of time, others for longer, less intense, but each contributing in our own ways to kind of our understanding of what's here and how that might change over time. And so that's, it's kind of, I appreciate that, I guess, that mm-hmm. sort of even longer, you know, more than a lifetime perspective and the ways that you know, what each of us is doing in our own ways here through our own curiosity and interest and then sharing it. And now through the, you know, how easy it is to share through iNaturalist, the ways that we contribute to that. I like to imagine us being part of that sort of stream of efforts over the years.
I think we are. I think Sitka's doing a good job. I think it's definitely lots of voices adding to that stream of information.
Well, yeah, and we should probably wrap up here. So any other final thoughts from either of you before we close our conversation for the day?
Yeah, just I guess nothing comes to mind as I think that over really quickly. What about you, Paul?
I feel like there hasn't been a good new reference out in print lately. I'm looking forward to the next one.
That sounds like a topic for the library show.
You and Paul, and we'll have Kitty, and you'll all just come on to the library show, and you can talk about field guides, the newest field guides.
Oh, we can talk about our favorite field guides. Yep. Yeah, that'd be a fun show.
It sounds good to me.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thanks for having us on, Matt.
You've been listening to a conversation I recorded just a couple of days ago with Brooke Schaefer and Paul Norwood. I want to thank them for taking some time out of their day to visit with me, and thank you for joining me here on the Sitka Nature Show. As always, I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there. Until next time, this has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCAW, Sitka.